The big red button.
The big red button. We're live. Episode 21.
After a short break. Only 6 months.
A little hiatus. So here you say you're doing a little Webpack build tuning.
Actually, I was upgrading ESLint to unlock some new features that we specifically needed to allow linting both JavaScript and TypeScript projects or files with the same ESLint configuration. So ESLint provides an overrides key, which you can actually override the default configuration. So you can say override, and if the file like matches this regex, which is like TS or TSX, then apply all of these rules. And the newest version supports overriding the extend method. So the extend method is where you can put in all of the like recommended rule sets. So we needed to upgrade to get that functionality. So I was kind of working on upgrading ESLint and then adding the necessary parser and rules for supporting TypeScript. So now ESLint can run on a mixed code base with the same configuration in a single run.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah. I didn't realize how flexible ESLint was until recently too. We're kind of extending our usage of it at Handshake too. So yeah, and I don't know if we've covered this, but it's been a while since we've recorded, but we are no longer coworkers. So well, hopefully that'll give us twice as many new things to talk about because we'll be
more surface area.
Right. Exactly. But yeah, at Handshake, we're finally, one step towards kind of isolating the student team specific code. So, you know, again, we have a kind of a three different teams at like core product teams at Handshake serving each of our, you know, unique customer types. So students, employers, and universities. And one of the steps we're taking to, I guess, give the student team a little bit more flexibility, like being able to define our own ESLint rules as we are, is like one of the things, but also, you know, have some flexibility about using our own dependencies, establishing our own patterns and best practices on the student team. But we're planning to set up a Yarn workspace. From there, we can have our own package.json. We can isolate some of the student team specific dependencies, ultimately create a separate Webpack entry for student code that only gets delivered to student users, and start pulling out some of the, you know, dependencies that only the student team uses from the main package.json. So, and just, yeah, trying to bring down just deliver less code to people who don't need it, you know. But then one of the other benefits of that is that we are hoping to set up like a workspace level ESLint config where we might break away from some of the patterns that are currently in place on the rest of the team. And yeah, being able to kind of nest ESLint configs and override and extend things was something I was just looking at too. So
yeah, I was kind of surprised that it had that functionality because I haven't used it a lot either. And I originally tried to create a separate configuration because I assumed that like this duplication is just going to be better than trying to force this single configuration to run on two separate things that are just fairly distinct. But it actually ended up being easier to have a single shared configuration because now I didn't have to go and update all of the build tasks to run ESLint twice or run ESLint with this new configuration. But then also we have a few levels of those nested ESLint configs. So even if I defined a new one at the top level, it still picked up all of those in the nested subdirectories. And I was like, this is not worth trying to battle when the override works much better. And I think it's a lot simpler from the standpoint that you can just run ESLint once and it's linting the entire code base. And then we're also leveraging ESLint caching, which I don't know a lot of details about that, but it does seem to make a pretty impactful difference because as I was doing this, I think running two versions of ESLint and CI was causing some issues with that cache because the cache is shared between branches and it was my best guess is that it was somehow getting to a bad state, kind of like a corrupt cache that just wasn't valid. So I ended up just blowing that away in CI, and it added another 3 minutes. So I was quite surprised that that ESLint cache in CI is actually saving, if the math is right and it's an accurate kind of test run, it looked like up to 3 minutes on our code base, which I was kind of surprised by.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know if we are doing anything with the cache right now at Handshake, but that's definitely something I want to look at after this. And that's something that you were really seeing the main benefit from in CI, nothing locally.
So it is used locally, and it does seem to run significantly faster locally. I don't know the details of it, of like how it determines when it can use cache versus not, like if it is doing some content hash of files to determine if it needs to reparse those or exactly how that works. But it did seem to make some impact locally, but then other times it seemed to take just as long. So I'm not sure exactly on the specifics of that.
Interesting. Well, yeah, let's definitely add a link to that in the show notes, and mainly so I can see look at it.
Right. Yeah. Nice.
Another thing I know you're kind of early on in the process of is adopting TypeScript over at Wealthfront. You want to talk in a little bit about some of the tooling you have in place? So you mentioned ESLint. I'm curious, did you all reach for TS Loader, or are you using Babel with the TypeScript preset?
Yeah, we're actually just kind of starting the transition last week officially, or introduced some of the necessary tooling last week, and after this week it's kind of official that we're moving forward with it. So pretty excited about that, because I think we've both seen a lot of the great benefits that you get from TypeScript. I think especially in a large code base where you start to need to do large refactorings and those type of things, that having a little bit of type safety around and being able to follow a compiler offers some pretty awesome benefits. But yeah, so we're already using Babel. So we just added the Babel TypeScript loader. So that strips out the types and doesn't actually do the type checking, but it makes it valid so that Babel can actually do the compilation. So we'll have to run the TypeScript compiler separately to do just the type checking. So we haven't implemented that yet, because we want to start to get a little bit of critical mass behind adoption of TypeScript first, I think, and start to ramp everybody up. So I think this will be an interesting experience for me, because in the past I've mostly worked on either JavaScript from the beginning or TypeScript from the beginning, never a JavaScript that's transitioning to TypeScript. So I think it'll be cool to see how those kind of interact and how that kind of all works together.
Nice. I'm in the process of, I just did a spike earlier this week on transitioning us to use Babel Loader instead of TS Loader. Ultimately, we're doing the type checking in a fork process anyway, and we're still using, you know, in CI is really the main place we actually need the compiler. And then everyone's got their own linting set up in their editors as well. So I don't think we're getting a ton of benefit from TS Loader directly. So I was interested to tap into kind of the Babel ecosystem, get rid of, like right now we're using polyfill.io, but eliminate the need to like be dependent on this third party resource. And then we have a handful of other just polyfills that we have in place right now. And also some things that Babel lets us get past that a polyfill just can't is like the class syntax in ES6. Like we wanted to update our build target because we were polyfilling things, but there's some syntax like classes that you just can't polyfill, but being able to perform transformations on the code directly, we were able to, you know, update our build target, kind of transform classes still into, you know, ES5 or whatever the equivalent is. But yeah, I think it'll be a nice move. Another thing we were looking at after that is potentially trying to use React Hot Loader again. There's a handful of places where we set up manually hot module replacement, just with, you know, the tooling that Webpack gives you out of the box. But I think we are, as our Webpack like build times get longer and, you know, our Rails server runs relatively slow in development. So if you're really doing front end development, you know, that full page refresh, pulling down the data you need to render the components, and it can be kind of a long feedback loop. So yeah, I was curious to try out some of that again. Is that anything y'all are doing over there? Anything with hot module replacement?
Yeah, I think there was just basic support recently just added for that. And I think it's functions in a similar way. I think right now it will hot replace if it's possible. Otherwise, it'll just do the hard page reload. I honestly haven't dug into it too extensively, so I'm not certain on the details. But it seems to behave in a very similar way to the way that you're just describing. I feel like I have seen some things recently that there's better support coming for hot reloading, or I believe React Native has much better support, and that's being converted to an approach that will also work with React on the web, but I'm not certain about that. I'll try to find some links and maybe we can add those to the show notes if I'm able to find them.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. And yeah, on the documentation of the React Hot Loader repo, they call out, like, if you're using React Native, don't use this project anymore. If you're still using Webpack, you know, this is still the right solution for you, but they link off to a pull request. Yeah, that's still open for exactly what you're talking about. So yeah, hopefully that story improves soon. But I know it's because, yeah, I've had very mixed results getting hot module replacement working. It's not quite clear to me why it can't in some cases do it, and sometimes it can. I feel like I need to play around a lot more to figure out, to narrow in on exactly like what types of things are not, I don't know what it, like, prevent module, like hot module replacement, but.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. So if you find any more there, please share. Very, very interested. Back to what you were saying with the TS Loader and Babel. Do you know if there's any, so aside from, I'm pretty sure TS Loader can do the type checking, but it sounds like that it's not being used for that, and you're using Fork TS Checker for the actual type checking. Aside from that, is there any other functionality that you lose out on by switching to Babel, or are there any like kind of performance or runtime characteristics, or is it pretty much just like a one-for-one swap? Most people won't even notice it. There's no feature loss, no feature gain, no performance change.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a trade-off. Like, I think you get a little bit of a performance gain because the Babel TypeScript preset, like, they don't do anything with the types. I mean, they just remove them. I think the TS Loader, there's still a level of checking that you get. Like, you can disable, like, transpile only is one setting, but there's another one that I think we're still using. Sorry, I'm forgetting exactly. But even with, it sounds to me like, you know, because they do literally nothing with the type information in Babel, that should be a little bit faster, but we were seeing about the same production build times. And I kind of attribute that to, you know, we probably got a little bit of a performance win, but I also like got rid of all of our polyfills, and I set up Babel, what is it, preset ENV to like polyfill things for us. So, and then some of the other transformations like supporting class syntax and things like that, while still delivering like an ES5 build target. Yeah, I forget exactly our configuration settings, but yeah, so I think it's kind of it ends up being a horse piece, but we also get to get rid of our old polyfills, stop making that call to polyfill IO. But I think the biggest benefit is being able to use the Babel Loader's cache directory option. With that, I was noticing like full rebuilds locally were significantly faster. And, you know, it's hard to say just with little bit of testing I did on just my machine, but it seems like builds were snappier, you know, a couple seconds instead of like 4 or 5 seconds that I was seeing in TS Loader. But I'm in the process of getting this PR ready, so you can, I think I'm going to make a separate script in our, you know, package.json where you can run like the a new version of like Webpack dev server where there's a flag or something that uses Babel loader instead of TS loader, so I can start getting some metrics and like feedback from the team and check if there really is much of a performance difference. But yeah, one, like measuring the impact of some of these Webpack changes is, I don't know, it's tough sometimes to really be confident in like and even like the timing that you get on your machine, it's like, you know, what other stuff did you have running on your computer? Like what tabs did you have open in your browser that might have like, or yeah.
Curious on the Polyfill IO stuff. I know we talked about that a little bit, but I don't think too extensively. Does that just always include the polyfill? So even if it's a browser that supports whatever's being polyfilled, that's going to still be loaded? Or was that done dynamically depending on the browser version or whatever might need that polyfill?
Yeah, it's my understanding that it only delivers what's necessary for the browser. I don't know exactly how it does it, but I assume you can get the browser agent in the request and then figure that out and only deliver back the things that that you know you need.
That would make sense. So that is a maybe potential slight loss with this approach, is that those polyfills are always going to be part of the bundle.
Yeah, they'll always be in the bundle, but we do eliminate an HTTP request for polyfill IO. And I think the other thing for us though is that, like I mentioned, we could not update our build target. Now we can. So all the places that we were saying like transpile down to ES5 compatible JavaScript, we can actually say like, no, use whatever the latest syntax is. We have polyfills in place, and then transform classes. So like, I think our bundle size will actually be smaller because we won't have, just because we can use the new syntax and the polyfills rather than, you know, transpiling.
Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. So is the version or the target only defined in tsconfig, or is that defined in another place as well? Because I know there's the tsconfig target, and you can set that to ES5, ES6, ESnext, whatever you want. But is there something else after that in the build step that then does further compilation or transpilation?
Yeah, so this is where I don't know the whole story yet. I haven't gotten there yet in our transition. But if we decide like Babel loader will work for us, will work better for us than TS loader, I assume we configure everything in Babel RC and it just ignores the TS config. And the TS config is mainly for the tools that we have in place for that are doing linting and type checking. So like our in VS Code, we're still going to want that to look at TS config. Our actual like type checking in CI. But otherwise, I think everything's happening in Babel. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. I'll report back on if I am able to find any metrics that I feel like are, you know, kind of validated enough to share. But yeah, in CI right now, which I feel like is the only reliable measurement, it's basically the same build times for a full production build.
Nice. That's cool. Do you know if what you were talking about, the Babel cache or whatever it was for kind of the incremental builds or repeat builds, can you persist that between CI runs to potentially improve the performance of the production builds?
Yeah, I don't see why you wouldn't be able to. I'm pretty sure it writes them to disk, so I feel like you could copy those over, but I am totally unfamiliar with how that works. But probably worth exploring at some point. But I mean, I think like front-end build times are not really the bottleneck in our like CI or like deployment process, but you know, our builds do kind of are growing kind of linearly over time. And I think, yeah, it will become more of an issue at some point. But that maybe is a decent segue, those linear build times. Part of the reason we have that is because, you know, we use CSS modules. We write a lot of styles that, you know, ultimately probably look pretty similar, like add some margin and padding on different elements. And like a lot of them kind of look like utility classes, but we're not using anything like Tailwind or actual just like, yeah, utility classes. So I know that's something you've been looking at a lot recently. I know you've been looking at, well, you mentioned Tailwind, Braid, and probably some others as well, but that idea of going all in on using utility classes rather than writing custom CSS. And one of the benefits is that your build size doesn't increase as you, like, initially you may have deliver more styles because you have a whole bunch of potentially unused classes, or I guess you can probably filter those out, anything you're not using too, I'd imagine. But yeah, once you have those in place, your builds don't really grow because you're doing so much styling with existing classes. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, kind of. I think the general idea is kind of exactly what I've kind of been exploring. I think more specifically encapsulating those utility classes in components in some way so that you still don't have to use CSS classes directly, and you can still kind of remain in this mental model of React using components to wrap other components and provide the spacing between them or around them or whatever it might need to be.
Nice. Yeah, I like the idea of like you said, staying in that kind of React mental model and providing some of that flexibility to, I want to say like design in the browser, but that's not necessarily it either. But be able to accommodate all these different like combinations of styles using utility classes rather than like writing custom CSS. And I think one of the things that you and I have talked about in the past is like there's this spectrum between that you can be on with like not writing any CSS and relying entirely and like minimizing the number of like options or like variations and things for developers. So like Bootstrap is maybe an example that we used at Handshake in the early days. And it was great because you didn't have to think about, you know, how much padding should this have? Like you did have to decide, like, do I want a large or a small or a medium button? But you didn't have to think about some of those. We weren't able to even, we didn't have the option to select any different, paddings or margins or things like that. Like spacing, I guess, is maybe the theme here, but like, that enabled us to move really quickly, but then the constraints were so tight that design, wasn't, once we really had a design team, they were a little bit too strict for, you know, to work with and for the design team. So naturally we kind of designed beyond those. And I don't know, there's just always this, like the other end of the spectrum would be like, no kind of constraints in the engineering side, writing custom CSS. And, but yeah, I think some of these things we're talking about are a little bit more in the middle. It's like, there's almost an infinite number of like layout or styling options without writing any additional CSS. And if you think about, like building prototypes and things like that, I think it unlocks a pretty cool like developer experience. But I know you've been spending a lot more time thinking about this than me. And you're even on kind of the UI toolkit team.
Yeah. So next week I'll be joining the UI toolkit team at Wealthfront as the web engineer. So there's already an Android and iOS engineer. So I think it'll be pretty exciting to be able to work with other engineers that are doing the same thing, but on other platforms, and seeing how a lot of these kind of principles and ideas and things translate cross-platform. And I think these are things I haven't thought about before, but I think are really important. So I'm excited to kind of dive into that and see how all of those pieces fit together.
Nice. Well, yeah. Do you have any high-level thoughts or things you want to share based on your explorations? And I guess maybe going into some of the principles and things that you hope to kind of follow as you build out the web toolkit?
Yeah, so I think I have some maybe strong opinions, I guess, on what makes a good design system versus maybe a not so good design system. I think those can change a little bit depending on context. So some of these are maybe a little strongly worded in the sense that, like, you should never do this or always do this, which I think those rules can be broken on occasion with very good reason, but I think it's just easier to think about if you make them like always or never, to just kind of put out some basic rules of how to think about a design system. But I think one thing that I've struggled with for a long time when working on some of these design system related components, I think going back to the classic example of a button, is when you have two buttons next to each other, which is happens pretty often, you know, like the cancel save or like edit cancel or okay cancel, whatever combination it might be. You almost always want that spacing between them, that 8 pixels or 16 pixels or whatever it is. So in the past, I've kind of thought the approach is you have these two buttons. If they're next to each other, just put that spacing there. So the button itself would have a sibling selector, a CSS sibling selector. So the second, third, fourth, everything up to the nth component, but not the first, would have that left margin and would give that spacing between those buttons. This worked fairly well until it doesn't. So this works well for the 80% case. But now when you don't want that spacing, say for whatever reason you want those buttons touching because you just have this like weird UI constraint, or you're applying custom styling that will put in the proper spacing, now you need a way to opt out of that or override it. So one approach is put a class name on there. But now how are you going to limit that to only margin attributes in that class name? You could have any of the CSS attributes. Kind of one of my principles that I outlined is no class name prop. And the idea is that, or at least my thinking around that, is that by introducing a class name prop, you've effectively introduced an infinite number of states into that component, because you can use every single CSS attribute, every value. You have no idea what's being injected into that. And so now when you're trying to maintain that in the future, you technically have to support an infinite number of states in that component, which is just a maintenance nightmare. So I'm generally kind of opposed to the class name prop for that reason, but you still need to allow like customization of this layout or whatever it is. So in the past, I've added a prop called fitted, which I think we've talked about plenty of times. And I agree that it is not a great option, but it effectively just removed the spacing. So the idea was that when you have a component with whatever spacing, if it's top, if it's maybe even padding, this fitted prop would just kind of remove that. And it's kind of like an opt out for that 20% case, where you're going to then apply custom styles around it in some way. But with that approach, now you have to add those custom styles. So now say you want these buttons to be laid out a little differently. Now you're going to write a custom div or custom element with some custom styles, kind of like what you were talking about. And now you're adding a little bit more CSS. Probably that CSS already exists somewhere in the code base, but it just isn't reusable or doesn't make sense to reuse in this context. So now that's a lot more work for that 20% case. So the other option is to just not bake any styling into it at all, which now you have custom elements everywhere. So I think this is kind of this like world that I just described is kind of where I personally had been going back and forth on and around. And like, there's got to be a better approach to spacing in components. And I know you and I have talked about it a lot, and we've never quite kind of pinned down what we thought was the thing that was missing. But recently I came across this talk from, I believe it was ReactConf Australia, by Mark, who works on the Braid design system, and he shared two components specifically. There's a ton of components in there, but I think the two components that like really stuck out to me were the stack and inline components. And these are effectively only layout components. And the idea is that you can use these to wrap other components and do provide the layout you need. So the stack component does, so the stack component applies margin between elements that are stacked. So say you have like, it's kind of common to call it like a button block, where it's just like the full width, it's a block. So you have like a list of buttons and they're all kind of blocked. Now you probably want some spacing between those as they're stacked like that. So you can wrap all of those buttons in the stack component, and then it will iterate through those and apply the proper margin. Similar with the inline, this is, I think, most common with kind of a like tag type of UI. So say you have some kind of post and it has 20 tags on it, and you want those all to be inline, but you want them to have margin between them. And then if those wrap, you want some margin above those so that these tags are never touching. So that's what the inline component does. And I think, again, this solves the majority of use cases. But now all of your base components, your button, your avatar, all of these other things can have no margin baked in at all. And you can use these layout components to add the margin you need. And now in that 20% case where you just need this really custom style, there's no opting out of anything because these base components don't have anything baked into them. And you can still write that custom element or custom CSS or whatever. But I think there's a lot of other layout components that can solve, I don't know, 95% of use cases. So hopefully with the combination of all of those, you can drive the need for custom styles lower and lower, but increase the rate of like reuse of a lot of these base components because they aren't conflicting with their built-in layout. And then I think the other nice thing is these layout components have, or you can make it so that they have a really nice API so that, for example, you can say the spacing size should be small, which corresponds to your small variable. So you don't have to make sure that when people are writing custom styles that they're using the right spacing variables because it's just baked in as part of the component. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of exciting things here. They're actually like super, super simple components, and you could probably write it in like three lines of code, which I think is kind of funny how simple it is, but how powerful they are.
Yeah, I do love the simplicity of these and just the flexibility that they provide. And I mean, yeah, like you said, we've had a lot of conversations about spacing in particular, and it just never felt like we got it right. And we talked about like more of an extreme with like a spacing component that would actually need to wrap around all of your components to provide the spacing you want. But yeah, I like the mix of like this isn't just kind of a dumb component that just applies margin and like is styling itself. It knows, like, it makes some modifications to the child elements, right? Like it's feels like kind of the right mix where it provides, you know, the API developers want, but doesn't produce just miserable markup, you know, for the browser. Because yeah, I think one of the issues we always ran into was just like all this extraneous markup that we'd end up having with some of the solutions we had talked about. But I know there's on that note of components being a little bit smarter and doing some interesting things, you've called out a few things to me that I thought were really interesting that the design system did, like handling colors and making sure things are accessible. Anything else you want to call out?
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that I came across was it seemed to be using this pattern of setting a provider, a React context provider, with the background color in some scenarios. And then the text component could use React context consumer to consume that background color and determine the proper text color that should be present on that background color. So I think this is something that could potentially also be achieved with CSS. I think you probably have a little bit more power and control and flexibility using React context. But it was just an interesting kind of concept of the idea that you shouldn't manually be needing to set the text color in all of these different places when above it, you're explicitly setting the background color, and you really should only be using a defined set or a specific color in that context. So I think that was kind of a cool approach. One other thing that I hadn't seen before was this idea of effectively cropping text so that it was perfectly aligned to its container. So I know very little about fonts, but I do know that when you set, for example, font size 16 pixels, you're actually getting a lot of white space around that font oftentimes. So now when you put that in a button or say you stack those, you're going to automatically get some spacing in there that you probably don't want or can't really calculate for. So if you want 16 pixels between two paragraphs of visual white space, you probably only need to put 10 pixels in there because you're getting this like 6 pixels of magical white space around this around this font. So the approach they use, and it was covered in the talk, is first aligning the text to the baseline. So you move the text down with a transform so that the baseline sits on the bottom of the box. And then you use a negative margin top to kind of clip the top of that. So now if you stack these, like assuming this was a text component, you have no spacing between them. And now you can fit these directly into this stack component or inline component and achieve effectively perfect spacing between text and other components, which I think is just a really cool idea because I feel like I've paired with designers in the past and they've been like, oh, the spacing just doesn't feel right. And I've been like, well, yeah, that's because it's kind of baked into this typography and is like something we just kind of have to deal with, but never considered an approach like this, which I think is pretty exciting. So I kind of dug into that a little bit and was actually trying to figure out how they calculated that. So I ended up going much deeper into fonts than I wanted and learned about a lot of font attributes that I didn't even know existed and learned that it's a lot more confusing than I thought it would have been. I would have expected fonts to be a little bit more standardized, but they have all of these different parameters and they almost have no constraints. So like they kind of define, from my understanding, kind of define what the like base height of this font is, but then it can ascend above that. And in my head, like it shouldn't be ascending above the kind of defined height of things. So I was trying to understand all of those values and how they got to the effectively the transform and then the negative margin values, which there's a lot of complexity around that.
Yeah, I know one of the things we talked a little bit about offline was just at what point are we being a little bit too smart in our presentational components? You know, one of the things that I like about the presentation layer is the lack of kind of logic and opinion sometimes. And yeah, that in particular feels like, I mean, it's cool what it unlocks in terms of like being able to apply spacing, but it just, yeah, there's a number of things in here that I feel like, I'm like, oh, that's really cool, but that feels a little scary to me. But I guess that's, you know, kind of par for the course with React itself and like, you know, re-rendering the DOM, applying, you know, attributes and styles in line. Like there's all kinds of stuff that, you know, assumptions and opinions that I've had for a long time or like generally accepted like principles and guidelines that, you know, because things have evolved the way they have and so quickly, like a lot of those just aren't valid anymore. So it's I don't know, it's interesting to kind of reevaluate some of these with all the new information we have.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's kind of interesting to that point of how sometimes your assumptions around some of these things or what you presume to be constraints block exploring some of these areas. So for example, like you were saying, the stack component, the implementation of that is iterating over every child element and then wrapping that in another element that applies the spacing, which in my mind is just like something that shouldn't be done because you're effectively what seems like unnecessarily adding more elements to the DOM. But in reality, that's probably not a problem. And when it becomes a problem, then you can address it. So it's interesting how some of these things can kind of be hidden behind some of the assumptions and what I presume to be constraints.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, anything else you want to hit on around design systems, Spencer?
Well, I feel like this is a topic we could probably talk about all day, but I think that kind of covers some of our recent explorations around spacing and how that kind of fits into design systems.
Yeah, I'd love to follow up at some point as you start to roll some of these changes out. I think one of the big things that we've talked about potential benefits, I guess, is that like I think using kind of like utility classes, having so many more kind of layout and design options built into your components, you can accommodate a lot more, I guess, requirements or requests from design. But can we get to the point where design and engineering are really thinking in speaking the same language when it comes to design? So yeah, I'm really curious to hear how it goes kind of adopting this, and if it is, you know, possible if it maybe improves the partnership between design and engineering, like how receptive they are to kind of thinking in this way, or possibly even prototyping in components rather than, you know, Figma or sketch files or whatever.
Yeah. Being able to prototype in components would be a pretty awesome place to be in.
Absolutely. It's the dream. But well, that's all for today. Show notes can be found at
rubberducking.fm/21.
See you next time.